So this is going to report work by a lot of people, especially Aldo Rodriguez Puebla and Christoph Lee, a grad student at Santa Cruz. Christoph, would you stand up so people can recognize you? Christoph also has a beautiful poster that I'll refer to. Now, I'm going to apologize in advance. I have a lot of things to tell you, 8 major points, that are extremely relevant to this conference. So I'm going to have to go very fast, too fast, I'm afraid. There's this paper that we put on that was published last year, which is basically analyzing the Bolshoi-Planck and multi-dark-Planck simulations. We made all of the Peter Baruzzi's beautiful merger trees and halo catalogs publicly available. One of the things that is relevant to this conference is if you look at the evolution with redshift of the Peebles definition of the spin parameter, it strongly declines with redshift, very systematically. That's not true for the one that was introduced in the second of the thesis papers that James Bullock did with me. So that's going to turn out to be relevant. Now, jumping to a different subject, in this paper, we noticed that there is remarkable independence of mass and redshift in the dispersion of the accretion rate of dark matter halos. The dispersion is about 0.3 or 0.4 dex at all redshifts and all masses. Now that's a remarkable fact because it's very reminiscent of the fact that the star formation rates on the main sequence show a similar behavior. If you assume that there isn't much evolution, as Baruzzi et al. And Master et al. And others have found, in the stellar mass-halo mass relation out to redshifts of about 3 or 4, then if you take the derivative of stellar mass with respect to time, it's the derivative of the virial mass-stellar mass relation with respect to virial mass, and then virial mass with time, that's the accretion rate, plus the change due to the change in the stellar mass-halo mass relation. If this is small, then the accretion rate determines the star formation rate with a slope given by the slope of the stellar mass-halo mass relation. That's just simple calculation. That means that we can deduce the scatter of star formation rates, if this is true, and we get results consistent with observations. Now, we're assuming this is true on average. It certainly has to be true on average. If it's true halo by halo, we call this stellar halo accretion rate coevolution, SHARC. And the reason we introduced that acronym is that we then apply this to bathtub models. So we put the SHARC in the bathtub. And then we can, for example, calculate things like the mass accretion, the mass loading factor. And we get results that are very consistent with observations and other theory. We also can use this to predict the star formation rates on the main sequence, and the results are remarkably good. Okay, next paper. This is a massive paper, 43 pages, that was just accepted by monthly notices, and the final version was on the archive as of yesterday. What we did was to take 20 fairly recent papers on stellar masses and 20 fairly recent papers on star formation rates, and we tried to make them all as consistent as possible. Same assumptions in surface brightness corrections, dust modeling, nebular emissions, stellar population synthesis, and cosmology. And after we homogenized them, and then ran an MCMC with the 13-parameter fit that we use, similar to Baruzzi-Webster-Conroy, we actually got really good stellar masses as a function of redshift, and also very consistent star formation rates as a function of redshift. And we're willing to make all of this massage data publicly available if people are interested. Almost all the results from this paper can be downloaded from a remarkable app. So we looked at the literature on quenching. Many people have written papers with different definitions, but it turns out that you can summarize them pretty nicely with a simple function of quenching mass versus redshift. The middle band is the 50% quenched. This is 25% quenched. This is 75% quenched. The median halo growth from Bolshoi-Planck and multi-dark-Planck is here. We use this plus the stellar halo mass relation, this is the evolution of that, in order to relate the growth of halo mass to star formation, to stellar mass. This is the corresponding star formation rate density and stellar mass density compared with the data compiled in the Madow and Dickinson annual reviews, and you see it works extremely well. So this is what it looks like, star formation rate versus M star, M vir, and Z. If you then project this way, you get the stellar mass, halo mass relation, and the redshift dependence is colored. Now we're adding two new things that weren't in the Monster et al. And Baruzzi, Wexler, Conroy 2013 papers. One thing that we're adding is the evolution of the radial distribution of stars. And it turns out the data is really remarkably consistent from low redshift from Sloan out to redshift almost 3 from van der Velde's analysis of the Candles data. And the other thing that we did is to use information on the mergers of halos to deduce the mergers of galaxies. It's imprecise, but yeah, we're basically, the idea of this paper is make simple assumptions and just see how far you can go. So one of the things that comes out of that is we now can tell you how galaxy size, the usual half light radius, grows rather slowly with mass until quenching, there's the quenching zone, and then jumps up very rapidly. And we can also show that that's due to a big increase in the minor merger rate and a decrease, for that matter, in the major merger rate. Again, I don't have time to go into detail, but the paper's out. So here, what we're doing is color coding the ratio of the specific star formation rate to the specific mass accretion rate. Here it is as a function of halo mass. Here it is as a function of stellar mass. The quenching is associated with a transition from a low value, a high value to a low value. Now, the Shark relation that I mentioned says that the star formation rate is the ratio, the slope, the M star to M halo, times the mass accretion rate of the halos. You can then say that there's this parameter that says how good the Shark approximation is. One means perfect agreement. And what you see is that if you look at typical galaxy evolution, Shark is always well satisfied until quenching. You can also look at how the mass inside the surface density in the inner kiloparsec evolves. It's remarkable how flat these bands are. These are the same value of sigma 1, the surface density in the inner kiloparsec. So what you see is that after quenching, the value hardly changes. Here you see it very clearly. Quench and then flat. The radius, however, continues to grow after quenching. And as a result, the surface density inside the effective radius drops after quenching. And as I said, you can download essentially everything I've just shown you and make all the plots you like from this app that that Aldo created and is now online. This, of course, is in the reference to that is in the paper. As Rachel showed, if you calculate this 3D half mass radius that Andre emphasized is what you should use to properly compare spheroidal and disk galaxies, there's this remarkable independence with redshift of the ratio of the stellar radius, this 3D half mass radius, divided by the halo radius times median value of lambda, which is about 0.035 for the Bullock one. But remember, it drops for the Peebles one, and that's why, since the denominator is going down, the numbers go up. Using the methods of the Rodriguez-Puebla paper that I just showed you, you can actually deduce how these things behave at all masses and all redshifts, and they're actually quite consistent with the observations. Different subject now, jumping ahead. So it turns out that a significant fraction of halos lose mass. So if you look at all the halos at redshift 0, and you look especially at the ones whose mass at redshift 0 has dropped by 5% or more compared to the peak mass along the backward trajectory, you find two interesting behavior zones. So it turns out the ones that have just lost between just a little bit of mass and, say, 15% mass, they have concentration going down and spin going up. But the ones that have lost more than about 15 or 20% have spin going down and concentration going up. So we thought this was interesting to look at, and I don't have time to go into the details. You'll find them discussed with a beautiful example of each of these sorts of behaviors in Christoph Lee's poster, which is now up, basically what's happening in this small mass law zone is halos, after a major merger, they increase their mass, of course, but then some of that mass is cooled away, evaporated, because the halos are not in equilibrium, and as they come down, they have a virial ratio, kinetic over potential energy, that goes up to like 0.75 or 0.8 after the merger, so they're not relaxed. As it relaxes down to 0.5, then this is what happens. Now, the large mass loss is due to a completely different process. That's tidal stripping. That occurs actually very commonly in dense regions and low mass halos. And it causes the outer profiles to steepen for the halos. If you insist on fitting an NFW, forcing an R to the minus 3 outer, then that's going to give you an R sub S that's small and so a high concentration. And the spin drops because the material that is taken away is preferentially the high angle metal material. If you look in at the mass accretion rate as a function of density, this is a paper that was published last year, led by Christoph. The mass accretion rate is actually negative once you're at roughly 10 times average density, where a lot of halos live, for the low mass halos. For intermediate mass halos, not quite so much negative, but still, as you go up in mass, you stop to see this effect. So this is an effect that occurs because these galaxies are within the Hill radius, or close to the Hill radius, of a more massive halo, and they're being tidally stripped. Now, another thing that we noticed is that the spin parameter drops quite significantly once you get down to these low-density regimes. And this is very robust. It's true in all mass zones, high mass down to low mass. And that gives us a very important opportunity to test this dependence on lambda, which I'll come back to. So how would you do this? What you do is you measure the size of galaxies as a function of local density. And if you're in the low-density regime, if lambda is controlling the size, those galaxies should be smaller at the same stellar mass, actually at the same halo mass, but as I'm going to show you, that's the same as the same stellar mass. So this has been done most recently in this paper by Sebrian and Trujillo, and what they found was just the opposite. If anything, the galaxies in the low density regions are slightly larger, not smaller. However, they went out to redshift 0.12 in the Sloan catalog, which means that they're only complete to about 4 times 10 to the 10 solar masses, which meant that a lot of their galaxies are actually spheroids or spheroid dominated. So we're doing the same thing, but with shallower catalogs, where we're going to be using a sample that's dominated by disks. And moreover, we're measuring the lambda in a mock catalog by exactly the same methods, either counting galaxies and apertures, distance to the nth nearest galaxy, Voronoi tessellation volume, etc. We're using exactly the same method. I don't yet have a result. We hope to have answers within a few weeks. The important point to realize, this is not about simulations. This is testing whether in galaxies, real observed galaxies, the lower lambda in low density regions means smaller size. Now, moving on to yet another topic, a paper that we're finishing. Does it matter where you are in the cosmic web when you're talking about the properties of dark matter halos? Or is it density that really matters? And the answer is, the web doesn't care about any property that we have yet discovered of dark matter halos. The web is irrelevant. Density totally controls. So that's what this shows. The black things are in voids. The blue to green are in walls, boundaries between voids. And the sort of purple to yellow, that's all environments, which means mostly filaments. And if you look, for example, in a little bit more detail, there are some subtle effects. So the spin parameter always is lower in low density regions. In intermediate density regions in voids, it's a little bit lower. The median is a little bit lower than in walls and in filaments. But when we looked at the full distribution, you hardly can see any difference. So the differences are very subtle. So the conclusion is that the same environmental density, halo properties are independent of cosmic web location. It doesn't matter whether halo is in a cosmic void, wall, or filament. What matters is the environmental density. The gamma data show that the galaxy luminosity function is also independent of web environments at fixed density. That's Elizabeth Eardley et al. It does contrast with a paper by Matucci, Libeskind, and Hoffman. 5 minutes, great. Okay, so moving on, yet another topic. So does it matter when you do abundance matching what the local density is? Or can you just do abundance matching with the same standard halo mass, stellar mass correlation or halo mass luminosity correlation? And the answer is the density doesn't matter, pretty much. So what we did here is we filled our dark matter halos with luminosities from observations from K-band to U-band. And then we observed and separated them by counting galaxies out to 8 megaparsecs, and which is exactly what was done in the McNaught-Roberts paper, the gamma paper. And we're using their same density ranges. And what you see is that on the whole, from K-band to U-band, the results are almost exactly consistent with observations. So observations are the points, and the results are the curves, except that the gamma results are plotted as this dashed, these dashed curves, as you see, agree very well. So fantastic simplification. But notice the discrepancy. Bright galaxies at very low densities in U-band and to some extent in G-band are above this, and that's because the accretion rate doesn't drop. In fact, it stays high in low densities, even for low-mass galaxies, low-mass halos. So what's happening is we're seeing the effect of star formation in these short wavelength bands. This is still preliminary, but we're pretty sure it's right. We're finishing that paper up. What about the mass function? So these are the mass functions, and the mass functions, again, behave very similarly. The observations agree with the simulations. So to a very great extent, mass functions also are independent of density. Jumping to a last topic, I just want to elaborate on something I mentioned in this challenge, make a prediction for James Webb. So this is data from the Kandel observations. These are galaxies from redshift 1.5 to 2, and this is the lowest mass bin and the next lowest mass bin, so going up to 10 to the 10 stellar mass. And notice this roughly inverted V-shaped distribution of axis ratio, so histogram of axis ratio, peaking at about 0.3, falling off rapidly with little around axis ratio 1. Now, spheroids are going to have axis ratio 1 no matter how you look at them, and disks are going to have an axis ratio between 1 face on and whatever the thickness of the disk is, 0.2. The fact that we see very few near 1 strongly limits the fraction of disk or spheroidal galaxies. Most galaxies are thin little sticks. It's true for redshifts 1.5 and up, for 10 to the 9.5 and 10 to the 10 stellar mass, and down to redshift 1, and maybe even below, for the lower mass up to 10 to the 9.5. Now, nearby galaxies are mostly disks and spheroids are a combination, but these distant galaxies are pickles. And when we looked at our simulations, and I have to confess, the simulations were done before we had these observations, but we didn't notice. Other people haven't noticed either. But when we looked at them, it turned out every one of our simulations behaved the same way. I'm just about finished. So when the centers are dark matter dominated, this dotted line is the ratio, this side matter dark matter dominated, this side stellar dominated in the center. And the dark matter dominated ones are primarily elongated, and the star-dominated ones are not. And the stars are following the dark matter. And the dark matter elongation turns out to be very aligned with the filaments on large scales. So that's my talk. Here's a summary of all 8 points. Sorry to have to go so fast. If I've been given a little bit more time, I can do it more slowly. But I'll be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions for Joel.
Yeah, that's interesting. Some while ago, there were speculations about chain galaxies.
And there were complaints that they looked like chains or clumpy because one was observing in short wavelengths rather than long wavelengths. Do you see any wavelength-dependent variations in your conclusions about prolate versus
overlates? Well, it's an observational issue as well as a theoretical issue. And we've written a whole series of papers about clumpy galaxies. So the Elmgreen papers that you're referring to were indeed basically edge-on disks that had clumps. That's primarily what they were. And we can see that by looking at the clumpiness as a function of axis ratio. There's a series of papers by especially Yi-Ching Guo, a postdoc at Santa Cruz who just got a faculty position at the University of Missouri, and 2012 paper on fraction of clumpy galaxies, 2015 paper showing that a clear majority, 60% of all star-forming galaxies at all masses that we can observe with candles from redshift 2 to 3 are clumpy. So it's a very, that means, his definition is a clump has to have at least 8% of the restrained UV luminosity and be off-center. He's finishing a very detailed paper on observations where he shows that the radial profile in age, color, or attenuation is much steeper for the clump population than it is for the disk population. So the clumps are not just some kind of magnified disk phenomenon. They're really a separate phenomenon. So we see essentially the same series of phenomena in our simulations, these same VILA simulations that Fao Zhang was just talking about. And the best paper to look at there is the latest of the two papers led by Nir Mandalkar, Avishai's most recent finishing graduate student who's now a postdoc at Yale. I'll be glad to tell you much more privately.
So physically, what you're saying is that you think the clumps are an instability in the disk and not the result of very warfare?
Well, no, actually, we talk about ex situ clumps and in situ clumps. Roughly half the clump mass is actually ex situ clumps, i.e. mergers, but the vast majority of the numbers are in situ clumps, which are disk instabilities. It's all in those papers.
Frank? So I wanted to comment on the issue about the spin and your test that you suggest to see whether, as you put it there, galaxy size is determined by host halo lambda.
Yeah.
You would expect a correlation between galaxy size and host halo lambda only if also the halos in the different environments accumulate about the same fraction of baryons into the stellar mass. And if you think in terms of the sort of standard Moman-White model, we know that the size of the galaxy is proportional to the spin parameter, the halo size, and then there's that parameter MD over JD, what fraction of the mass goes into the galaxy and what fraction of the baryons.
So it turns out...
So there are strong indications and suggestions that halos of a given mass in different environments, in different density environments, are more or less efficient in forming stars. So if that is the case, you don't necessarily expect this to...
But I showed you what the results were. I can go back and show you again. It turns out that in the low-density environments, actually, this is a good one to use. So in low-density environments, that is, when you're down here, the accretion rate, that's the top plot, is pretty flat and pretty much independent of the environment, whereas the spin parameter drops quite significantly. So I don't think that there's much difference in the accretion rate in these low densities, as you actually pointed out yesterday in the discussion, whereas there's this big drop in the spin parameter. Second point, a halo or a galaxy that's sitting in a low density environment has always been in a low density environment. And the motion is from lower density to higher density.
I see a very strong dependence of the accretion rate of a halo on the density.
No. Yes, at high densities it falls off.
Yeah.
In fact, it becomes negative. But here we're talking about intermediate densities versus low densities. And there it's flat. Yeah, okay. So I think that... The point is, this is an opportunity to do an independent test, and now we're talking about real galaxies.
I just think that several people mentioned the thing of, you know, whether galaxy size determined by the spin parameter is we don't necessarily expect to see perfect correlation, even if they are determined by it. It's just
if the spin parameter is about 30% less in low-density regions than in medium-density regions, then if the spin parameter is determining galaxy sizes at the same stellar mass, which I showed you is the same halo mass, should be 30% smaller. Well, no, I mean, it follows.
So you comment on here for the gamma data, they showed the luminosity function didn't depend on position in the cosmic web. So I think it was 2013, there's a paper by a graduate student called Heiling Yan with Suhui Fan in Beijing, who looked at a number of properties in the Sloan data and looked for correlations to the cosmic web, I think with probably higher sensitivity than these gamma ones because they had larger samples. And there was also no correlation of color or star formation rate or any other property they could find at fixed a given density with the other
properties. Yeah, actually, I know that paper, but so we'll definitely refer to it.
So, but I'm surprised to hear you state this so strongly because one of your collaborators here is Miguel Aragon. So I know there is a community out there who argue very strongly that galaxy properties do depend strongly on the cosmic web. So I wonder if there's anybody else who wants to defend that. Because
well, so Miguel, of course, has seen all these results, and he's taking it philosophically. People who don't control for density will always find strong correlations because, of course, there are average differences in density.
No, I understand that.
Right, but so if you control for density, are you going to see what I showed you? And then what you find is that density controls.
Yeah,
okay, so. So I think let me say that very likely the orientation of planes of satellites does have something to do with the cosmic web environment. For example, the plane of satellites of the Milky Way, more or less a polar ring perpendicular to the disk, coincides with the local sheet.
So
M31 happens to be sitting in an intersection of two sheets, so it's slightly tricky. But anyway, that's the kind of thing where the local environment, walls and so on, matters. But for halo properties, it doesn't.
Simon, sorry, I got to... Excuse me. Marius Kaltun finds exactly the same thing. That's why he doesn't work on cosmic web anymore, because he says, so density angle. And the paper on the archive just a couple of days ago making very strong statements about it. Yeah, well, because he says he has to control the density.
We have one final question by Jordi Rose. Yeah, just following up on this correlation with the cosmic web. So here you're saying that halo prolateness does not depend on the cosmic web, but then you're saying that at higher redshift you're finding that these prolate galaxies must be living in filaments. So is that just because you're not controlling for density when you're making that statement?
No, it's a statement which you're... thank you for mentioning that. At these high redshifts, certainly above redshift 1 is the only place we've seen evidence for these elongated galaxies. We do see in our simulations a very strong correlation. When the galaxies are elongated, their long axis aligns with the longer axis of the dark matter. However, at low redshift, and incidentally, it's well known that this is also true for halos that are forming at high redshift. They tend to lie along the filaments, and moreover, as Bepi Torman first pointed out, and we've all agreed ever since then, they're being supported not by rotation, but by anisotropic velocity dispersion, much higher random velocities along the long axis than perpendicular. And it's the same thing with the stars and the galaxies, because they are also non-collisional. So they're also supported by larger velocity dispersion than the long axis. Then what happens is that there's a big inflow of gas, what we call a compaction event. You've got a big lump of stars in the center. That changes the orbit structure, and that's discussed in detail. All the torques are worked out in the Tomasetti paper. So that's the transition that turns galaxies from being these elongated things into being rounder or diskier.
All right, perfectly on time. Let's break, and we'll see you at 11. Thanks, Joel, again.